From the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, this is The Steady Stater, a podcast dedicated to discussing limits to growth and the steady state economy.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Brian Check, and today we have a special treat. In this, our seventh episode, we're actually going to have a guest. Now, we've always planned to make this a bit of a talk show, and my guesstimate, so to speak, is that we'll have guests perhaps 50% of the time. Our first guest is Laurel Hanscom, the Chief Executive Officer of the Global Footprint Network, an organization that is extremely important to us at the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And I think you'll see why as we discuss with Laurel the work of her organization. Before joining the Global Footprint Network, Laurel worked at Peace Corps headquarters in Washington, D.C., and served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador. She has a BA and an MA in geography from San Diego State University, and her research there focused on climate change vulnerability and agriculture. Laurel Hanscom, welcome to The Steady Stater.
So great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Laurel, we want to talk about Overshoot Day, which landed on August 22nd this year. First, what is the mission of the Global Footprint Network?
Thank you so much. You know, the mission of our organization is to make decisions in line with moving out of Overshoot. Our vision is a world where everyone lives well within the means of our one planet, within the means of nature. So very much thinking about how we can provide tools and data to support decisions that can help us get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly a laudable mission, really important in this century. And it's actually quite similar to our mission. But what are the main ways that the Global Footprint Network goes about pursuing that mission?
So the main ways that we have looked at pursuing our mission sort of changed through the years. Initially, our goal was to get national governments on board with using the ecological footprint as an indicator to measure their progress towards sustainability. In that process, we produced national footprint and biocapacity accounts, which we now publish on an open data platform. But what we realize is the data isn't quite enough. It isn't enough to put a graph in front of someone and assume that they're going to understand what it means and the direness of the situation, so to speak. So we've done a lot of work in the last 5 to 10 years to work with partners to show applications of the footprint in terms of working with cities, governments, but also a lot of nonprofits to show our impact on the planet. The other two big ways are through communication. So we have, as you mentioned, Earth Overshoot Day, which is our annual campaign. Earth Overshoot Day is the day of the year, of course, when we have used all the resources that will be regenerated over the entire year. And so annually, we publish that date. And we have a large campaign to raise awareness about the things that we can do to actually move the date. And then we also have an ecological footprint calculator. So anyone can go online to footprintcalculator.org and calculate their own footprint and also their own overshoot day to see how they stack up to other countries in the world.
Oh. And of those tools and resources that you have on the website, do you know which one is most frequently visited?
Hands down, it is the footprint calculator. Mm. We get a ton of coverage and media attention on Earth Overshoot Day, but really the footprint calculator is where people connect with the information and understand how it relates to their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you have any sense of what percentage of visitation comes from, let's say, students? Or any other breakdown among various elements of society?
Well, we like to think that everyone who takes it is a lifelong learner. But I think just over half, we understand that just over half are students, either in university or in high school. So we do recognize that a huge base of our traffic comes from young people who are hopefully taking that information with them and going out and changing the world.
Right. Yeah. And how long does it take a visitor to run their footprint calculation?
I think the average amount of time that people spend on the site or the footprint site is about 7 minutes. So I think you can get through it in just 6 or 7 minutes. But there are opportunities to put in more detail. So if you're really interested, there's plenty to dig into.
Well, we certainly encourage everybody to do that at least once and actually do it a number of times and try to ratchet it down. You go to www.footprintnetwork.org, and it's a pretty prominent feature at the website. Well, I can tell you that we're huge fans of yours at CASI. You're one of our strongest allies in helping raise awareness of limits to growth and the need for a steady state economy. And by the way, I understand you got a very early start in thinking about limits to growth. I mean, a really, really early start. Can you tell us just a little bit about that too?
Probably much earlier than most. So I guess my father is was a professor at San Diego State University, and he taught human ecology and biology. And all of his career in his lectures, he worked or he used information about the steady state economy, Daly's work, all of the ideas around limits to growth, and they all featured very prominently in his lectures. And so as a kid growing up, I heard about this stuff all the time. I mean, around the dinner table, it would be something that, not necessarily a topic of discussion, Laurel, here's what steady state economy is, and this is what you should do, right? But certainly it imbued my understanding of how the world worked. And so when I did get to college and learned for the first time in a formal way about steady state economy, it felt like gravity, right? It felt like, well, of course this is how the world works. And so sometimes I get really confused when I talk to economists in particular who sort of have a disconnection with the physical reality of the planet and the physical reality of our world, and believe that we can continue infinitely with the kind of growth that is really undermining our ability to thrive as a species.
Wow. Well, that's a fascinating story. And yes, very unique. I think most people don't get into the limits to growth findings until quite a ways into their career in environmental sciences, typically they're coming from. So it's great to have somebody on our first interview that has that kind of background. And and one of the reasons we wanted to interview you at this time in particular is what just happened on August 22nd. That was Overshoot Day, which was when, Laura, I'll let you finish that sentence and elaborate a bit on that.
Right. So August 22nd was the day in 2020 when humanity used all the resources that will be consumed over the entire year. And this is very significantly 3 weeks later, just over 3 weeks later than it was the year prior.
3 weeks later. Okay. And is that do you have a hypothesis? I guess we're probably thinking something about COVID or?
Very much so, yes. Mm-hmm. So this is, normally we would celebrate something like a huge shift in the date to something later in the year. But unfortunately, this came with a big toll, with a big cost, with the contractions that came from the COVID-19 virus and how that has essentially brought a lot of hurt and suffering to people around the world.
Right. Yeah. In some ways, we like to try to see the silver lining, but it hasn't been the greatest example of ratcheting down the size of that economy in terms of the struggles that's entailed, or the reasons for it to start with.
It does give us a glimpse mm-hmm. of what could be, right? We saw the world come together and very quickly take action to save lives.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are lessons that can be garnered from what we've experienced over the last 6 or 8 months. So while it isn't something to celebrate, I certainly think that we can take some lessons from this and see how that global collaboration can be enacted. I mean, we've been talking about this for years, right, Brian? This kind of thing needs to happen, but we really want it to happen intentionally. We want it to be done with thriving and good lives for people at the center of that, rather than through a disaster like what we've seen.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, like Herman Daly used to say, what we want is a successful, steady state economy, not a failed growth economy.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah.
In other words, we would like to do it by design, not disaster.
Yes. Yeah, not by disaster. Well, looking back then at some of the earlier overshoot days and overshoot day campaigns, do any come to mind as being particularly impactful or memorable in some way?
Let's see. It's an interesting question. I think, you know, the first actual campaign, overshoot day campaign, was in 2006, I believe, 2006, 2007. Prior to that, obviously, there had been overshoot days, right? We've been in overshoot since the early 70s. But that was the first time we started having annual campaigns. But I think the biggest sort of most meaningful shift that there's been since the beginning of the campaign is this idea of moving from just focusing on the doom and gloom of how scary the idea of overshoot is, to this idea that we're really trying to focus on how do we move the date. So we incorporated hashtag move the date as a way to galvanize support for the solution side. And how do we change this trajectory? How do we move the date and make changes in our lives and our society that'll keep moving that date back to December 20 or 31st and beyond.
Hashtag move the date. Yeah, that's great,
right?
One. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys have a lot of great slogans and rhetoric in the positive sense at your website too. I imagine you have to talk a lot of times and maybe shift your strategy at times as well in terms of that balance between alarming the public about overshoot and presenting a desirable solution to it in terms of moving the date. It sounds like you've trended in recent years toward the latter, but do you have criteria that sort of affect that in real time?
I think what we try to do is be realistic about what we're working with, right? So we don't see our data as being particularly disaster pushing or really focusing on the urgency, although it does. It's more that it's the context in which we're living, right? So the fact is we are using more than our planet can renew every year. That's just a given. And what we do with that information is kind of up to us. I believe personally in the power of human ingenuity, the power of us believing in each other and lifting people up. But I also understand that people act in their own self-interest as well. So I think we try to find ways to reach people where they are, and present the information in a way that doesn't elicit reactions that will sort of scare them into inaction, right? What we don't want to do is make people believe that we can't change this, because we can. The trajectory mm-hmm. is not great at the moment, but mm-hmm. we as a species have this unimaginable depth of ingenuity and power when we put our minds to something. And so I think that a lot of our messaging is centered around how do we pull that out rather than squashing it.
Do you ever wish that some of that ingenuity was geared a little more toward our policy goals, like our economic goals, for example, and maybe not so much technology to try to overcome or, you know, force our way over those limits and move that date just with raw technology?
Absolutely. Ingenuity is not, technology does not have a monopoly on ingenuity. I think ingenuity comes across all parts of society. I think you see this in the way that, for example, younger environmentalists are centering their work in intersectionality. That's ingenuity. That's moving past systems and patterns in the past that didn't serve the greater good, that didn't serve society. And absolutely, in terms of economics, rethinking what wealth is, rethinking what success looks like, all of that requires us to be, us to think harder and to believe in different things. And so, no, there's no technological solution that is going to be panacea for what we're facing. It has to come in all different parts of the work that we do.
We've been talking with Laurel Hanscom of the Global Footprint Network, and we'll be right back with her. But let's take a short non-commercial break now with Rick Tibbetts.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying the show. I just wanted to take this short intermission to suggest a book that I think you would love. The book is called Uncommon Sense: Shortcomings of the Human Mind for Handling Big Picture Long-Term Challenges. The author is Peter Seidel, one of the elder statesmen of sustainable studies. Seidel's unique contribution is an exploration of human nature, of the human brain, and why humans are so severely challenged to deal with limits to growth. I highly recommend this book, and you can pre-order a copy at www.steadystate.org. Just pan over to the Discover menu, and then click on the Steady State Press item, and you'll find it there. Now, back to the show.
I watched that 2.5-minute video you sent me called National Footprint Accounts, Ecological Balance Sheets for 180 Countries. It's really pretty effective and educational. Of course, it's not so easy to communicate the principles of that 2.5-minute video without the visual effects, but you think you can give us like a 1-minute version of it for the podcast?
I can try, that's for sure.
Okay. Or a 2-minute version.
All right. Well, I'll see what I can do.
Okay.
The National Footprint and Biocapacity Accounts are, let's see, where do I even start? Okay. So the National Footprint and Biocapacity Accounts calculate ecological footprint and biological capacity for every country, region, and the world. We use up to 15,000 data points per country per year to calculate footprint in five different biocapacity categories and six different use categories, including carbon footprint. We can think of this as a balance sheet where biocapacity is income and ecological footprint is expenditures. So it helps countries understand how far they are in the red, so to speak, so that we can compare across the world how our impact on the planet.
That's a really good way to describe it. And I think it helps to, it certainly the accounts should at some point in the 21st century be a central negotiation point for international diplomacy pertaining to sustainability.
We believe that to be true. You know, we have data going back to 1961, up until the most recent data years that are available. And so we can look at these trends and we can actually map it against economic trends to understand how world events and economic changes have impacted footprint by capacity as well.
Well, you know, another thing you did a good job of in that in the video was pointing out that any nation faces some really difficult trade-offs among land use decisions. For example, well, you use the example of forest restoration. So a country may want to restore forests for purposes of carbon sequestration, but that can come at the expense of short-term agricultural production. So what would you say are some of the other most common trade-offs a country faces when trying to do the right thing about climate change? Not only climate change, but, you know, getting its ecological footprint back down to its biocapacity.
Right. Well, the way that the ecological footprint accounts work is essentially we are looking at how much land or land equivalents, right, are available versus how many are required to provide the goods and services that we all use. And so in any case, any land use, if you have land use for one thing, you can't use it for another. For you can't have, you can't have fields of you know, agricultural fields in the same place that you have a freeway or, you know, a parking lot, right? So the decisions that we make in terms of how land is used inevitably influence what we do. And so in every case, every choice, every decision that's made around how we use the space that we're allotted, it's a trade-off. So the agricultural and forest land trade-off is a big one, of course, but also, you know, built-up land. The places, if we are extending into otherwise undeveloped land, then we're removing that land's ability to provide the services that they were previously providing. Mm-hmm. And here in California, that also has there are also sort of comorbidities, so to speak. Whereas we extend into forest land in our development, we are also putting ourselves in harm's way of things like wildfires, like the ones that we've seen over the last several weeks.
Mm. Yeah, that's a real wild card. But you, I think, as an environmental scientist, originally, you could see that coming. I remember taking courses in, I think it was 1988 from Malcolm Zwolinski at the University of Washington. He was telling us back then how this is a done deal. There were going to be these conflagrations, especially in the chaparral habitats of California. Yeah. And we're seeing it all over now.
I grew up in a rural part of San Diego County. And we've been, you know, this has been part of our reality for a very long time. And then I remember taking classes early in my educational career about fire suppression and how that leads to the really destructive kinds of wildfires that we've seen. And it's all related. I think one of the big things that we as an organization are trying to bring people, to bring people's attention is that these things that we're talking about, they're not separate issues. Mm-hmm. Everything comes back to these same overlapping and sort of systemic and system-wide issues. And I think the ecological footprint has been a powerful tool because it brings together different aspects of our natural resource overuse. And how we can, you know, how to identify places that we can make changes in the system to improve our ability to thrive on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Well, in gathering the data and making the calculations, I would imagine you get some real keen insights as well to what may be the limiting factor in a particular country or region or on the planet, the limiting factor. Let's put it in raw macroeconomic terms, like GDP. Yeah. And at CASI, I think you're aware of this. We often say that GDP is the ecological footprint in the sense that it's that human economic activity, you know, that's taking the resources. But anyway, if you were to look at it that way, let's say you're a conventional economist and you actually want the global economy to grow. You're an economist at the World Bank and you mm-hmm. are sticking to the rising tide lifts all boats metaphor and strategy. And so you want the global economy to grow. what would you say, based upon your research there at the network, would be the limiting factor if you had to identify that?
The limiting factor to our ability to continue growing the economy is the planet's ability to regenerate.
Mm-hmm. Any particular, like, of those five elements of biocapacity, would there be one that stands out to you at all, or is it pretty much just the mix, the emergent property of those five?
I think, you know, one of the things that I can say, I mean, I do think that we like to take all of these things together. I think, you know, as you all do, we see ecological footprint and GDP as sort of similar indicators, in the sense that they're giving us this big sense. And it's important to have local and complementary indicators to help drill down into the separate aspects of that. But I mean, as we look at the data, you know, 60% of the global ecological footprint is the carbon footprint. And so until we get the carbon footprint in check, we don't really have a shot of getting out of overshoot.
Okay. Well, we actually may want to bring you back on sometime to talk about that element in particular. But we don't have too much time left, so let's shift gears a little bit, and maybe you can tell us about some of the countries, the nations that you've been able to work most closely with. For example, are there any countries that have adopted ecological footprinting techniques for purposes of their own natural resource planning or even economic planning?
So the most recent example I have of work we've done with a country is Scotland, especially the Scottish EPA has adopted One Planet Prosperity as their sort of foundational, I should say, their framework for how they approach their work. And this is incredible because there are about a dozen different countries that have included ecological footprint as an indicator in either their planning or environmental or sustainability plans. More than that, actually, but with different levels of government. But SEPA, the Scottish EPA, has done this, has really taken this on wholeheartedly. So the One Planet framework now guides all of their decision making, and it has given them a way to sort of work more closely with other government departments, right? So the work that they're doing there has been really, I think it's been really powerful. And I hope that other EPAs and other, I mean, if economic departments could take ecological footprint as an indicator that helped guide their work, I think the world would be a better place.
Yes, that is a fantastic precedent. And thanks so much for letting us and our listeners know about that, because we're going to look into that and tout that, just like we tout. We often recommend, people ask us all the time about, well, what should we be looking at then if GDP is no longer the measure of success? And our response is, well, first of all, we don't want to just get rid of GDP. It's like if you have an obese patient, for example, if you're a doctor with an obese patient, the last thing you want to tell them is to throw away the scale. They need to monitor that even more going forward. But then we have to bring out the stethoscopes and the blood pressure cuffs and so on. Yeah, and the ecological footprint is one of those. I don't know. I guess you would pick your choice among the instruments. We could talk about that sometime. But let's see. Are there any?
I'll have to give that some thought.
yeah, that'd be great. What about? Are there any like low hanging fruits in terms of the points that you would like us to make during this interview?
I think that, you know, the steady state economy and the work that Cassidy is doing and the emphasis on GDP is important because it is a metric that is very well known from a policy perspective. We would love that ecological footprint had the power that GDP does to help drive decision making. And I think we have a lot to learn from how GDP has been integrated. But I do think that ecological footprint needs to be looked at alongside. And I think that there's a very strong correlation in many cases. But my hope is there wouldn't be, right? Like, my hope is that there would be a way that, that there'd be more divergence. And I wonder even if that's possible. And so maybe that's the deeper discussion we get into one of these days. But I think it's really interesting to look at them alongside one another. And I think that it's a great opportunity for your fans, your listeners, to dig a little deeper too. One of the coolest things about, we put all of our data online for free on an open data platform a few years ago. And one of the coolest parts of that is it gave us this opportunity to have a two-way conversation. We have all this data, we produce it. There's all kinds of interesting things that you can learn from it, but we're not economists and we don't necessarily as a small organization have the time or energy to go down in all of these different possible ways that the data can be interpreted. So I would hope or encourage you and your folks over there to start to dig into the free data that we have available online. And maybe we can come up with some cool ways to present that and double the impact, or hopefully more, of the work that we can do together.
Let's plan on it. Yeah, we've dabbled a bit with some of the data there, but we need to take a much deeper dive. You know, we have this project, we call it the GDP Correlates Project, and we look at various variables that we hypothesize would be correlated with GDP. And then we investigate the causality. So, you know, we do have a rough correlation performed already with the ecological footprint and GDP. But yeah, that's definitely due for more diligence and more depth. You know, we've had quite an informative interview already with Laurel Hanscom, the Chief Executive Officer of the Global Footprint Network. And again, we encourage our listeners to check out the really important work they do at www.footprintnetwork.org. And Laurel, thank you so much for coming on to the show. Once again, you're our very first guest. And it's,
I'm honored.
I think it's our honor too. So thank you so much. And we'll have you on again for sure. And keep up the great work out there, and be careful with the COVID and the fires and all the other challenges out there.
Thank you, Brian. You too.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.